from KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in Forum's second hour this morning, award-winning environmental writer Bill McKibben, author of The End of Nature, will be joining us to discuss his recently published book, Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. We'll find out why he feels the future needs to rest in local and regional communities and how all of us can contribute to resource sustainability and our own personal happiness. Forum is next, with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum. Best-selling author Bill McKibben, one of the first to write seriously about global warming, published his landmark environmental book, The End of Nature, back in 1989, and rendered for readers a fundamental philosophical shift in the way we humans relate to nature. Now he moves from concerns over deep ecology to concerns over deep economy in a recently published work, Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. Bill McKibben argues in this manifesto that since we don't have the natural resources to keep up with economic expansion, we need to go local, to look to cities and regions, to local communities for food and energy and culture and entertainment. Presently, the gross domestic product is three times what it was back in 1950. Bill McKibben supports the thesis that our society of mass affluence and mass consumption has also brought with it a diminishment of personal and subjective happiness. This, too, he argues, can be headed off or at least faced and confronted by going local. A former staff writer for The New Yorker, Bill McKibben writes regularly for Harper's, The Atlantic Monthly, and The New York Review of Books. In addition to The End of Nature, he is the author of Enough, Staying Human in an Engineered Age, and he's a scholar in residence at Millbury College in Vermont, and he joins us for our second hour. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, Michael.
Been quite a while, and we're still going local, huh?
Absolutely.
Well, in fact, it's not only the key, as you see it, to physical survival and the environmental predicament. It's also just necessity, really, here, in terms of facing what may be the future.
You know, since The End of Nature, I've been sort of thinking different approaches into this question of how we're going to accomplish the big change that we need to make to deal with global warming and the other huge environmental things that we're facing. I think we're only now beginning to understand that these are going to require really serious transformations of our economy. For me, part of the thing that really hit home was doing some reporting in the last few years, especially in China, and just seeing what that incredibly dynamic, vibrant economic growth looked like and trying to extrapolate what the world was going to look like before too long. The Chinese economy is growing at 10% a year. By mid-century, if that continues, they'll be as rich as we are. If they consume the way that we do, the current 800 million automobiles on the planet will have 1.1 billion Chinese ones added to them.
And they want
behind
their SUVs,
that the Indians.
Don't they?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, they do and they don't. I think that they're poised to make some real choices because they can see very close hand, not sort of global warming quite yet there, but the dramatic environmental effects of what they're doing. And they're casting about for what the model might be. Do we emulate America with its heavily individualistic society? Do we go for a more European model with more emphasis on community? How do we manage to meet the legitimate aspirations of the people who live here and at the same time make our nation and the planet habitable? That's a huge conundrum that everybody's starting to have to face and going to have to face more and more and more. And for me, that led me into these questions of economics, I think at a very lucky time, because all of a sudden, economists are beginning, at least some of them, to study these deeper questions about whether our current model, more is better, actually works not only ecologically, but works for human happiness, for human satisfaction. And the data is pretty convincing that it doesn't.
Yeah, I want to get into that data with you because I think it's important that listeners hear. But it's also, some would say, bucking against the tide here because of growth and globalization being so intrinsic and so integral to not only this nation's paradigm for itself, but to the developing nations, to India, to China, as well as nations that are trying to struggle out of their poverty.
There's no question that it's bucking against what we consider politically realistic at the moment. I mean, what did Bill Clinton say? It's the economy, stupid. You know, I mean, it's pretty much what we do. On the other hand, you know, our civilization is now bucking against fundamental laws of physics and chemistry. And we're beginning to see that with temperatures rising quickly and much that will follow in their wake. And, you know, intractable as our kind of political and economic decisions seem, they're a lot more tractable than the laws of physics and chemistry before which ultimately we're going to bend. And it's also true that they may be, you know, more tractable than the laws of human nature, which our economy seems not to be satisfying in some of the ways we would have thought it did.
Talking to Bill McKibben, his new book is Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. Not more but better. That's kind of the anthem here, isn't it?
You know, here's an interesting piece of data. Every year since the end of World War II, pollsters have asked Americans, are you happy? Which, as I've said to someone once, must be a kind of disconcerting question to get before dinner over the telephone, you know, from some pollster. But the number of Americans who say that they're very happy peaks in 1956 and goes pretty steadily downhill since. About a quarter of Americans will make that claim today. In the same 50 years, the average standard of living for Americans, our material prosperity, has almost trebled. Now, if the things that we kind of intuitively believe about the economy were true, those two curves should track in more or less the same direction. They shouldn't split fundamentally apart the way that they are. And
unless we were asleep in the 50s and awakened in the 60s with liberation and all that, that led us to the notion that we could be happier than we actually...
Or that we figured out that we it could be. More likely, what seems to have happened, to the degree that we can figure out the data, it seems pretty clear that what's happened is that our very prosperity has brought about a kind of social disconnection, a lack of community that Americans feel incredibly deeply. I mean, think about what started happening in the
1950s. This is bowling alone, isn't it?
Well, and even beyond. I mean, think about what happened in the 50s. We used all that prosperity mostly to build ever bigger houses ever further out in the suburbs. Mathematically, we reduced the odds that we'd even run into each other in the course of a day. You know, as a result, Americans have about half as many close friends as they did 50 years ago. They're far less likely to eat meals with friends, family, neighbors. It turns out that that really matters to us, you know, that we evolved to be, to place at least as high a premium on those sort of social connections as on stuff. And I mean, this sort of, it threatens to turn into kind of farce. Did you see the story in the New York Times last week about how the sort of new trend in upscale houses in America is to build them with two master bedrooms because husbands and wives don't really want to sleep in the same bedroom anymore because one snores and the other doesn't or something like that. I mean, that level of disconnection, which is part and parcel of that affluence, turns out to be, I mean, it's a kind of honest mistake perhaps that we made, but it turns out to have been a mistake. And one of the ways to remedy it, happily, I think, is to rebuild some of these local economies that cause us to depend a little more on each other and at the same time cause us to use a hell of a lot less fuel and spur global warming somewhat less.
I want to get into that with you as well. As I said earlier, Bill McKibben is one of the first to make us cognizant of global warming. But there's a kind. I mean, reading your book, I was thinking about my old friend David Brower, you know, one of the leading environmentalists here in California and worldwide for that matter. And he used to say, we've got to stop thinking growth. We've got to stop thinking progress. You know, it's almost like wired in us to think that way. Unwiring us, you're saying local again. Think local.
You know, people do a lot of preaching now about community. It's become one of those buzzwords, you know, but I don't think it's something that we can resuscitate by sort of moralizing about it. Community gets built when people have some reason to depend on their neighbors around them. So let's take an example. I mean, consider a farmer's market. Farmer's markets actually are the fastest growing part of America's food system. So that's good news. One of the things they do is save us energy. If you eat locally, you use something like a tenth as much energy to feed yourself dinner as if you order takeout from thousands of miles away, which is what basically we do every night. But more importantly,
even as your friend Michael Pollan points out, sometimes with organic foods as well.
Exactly right. More importantly, though, farmers markets have a sort of different function. A pair of sociologists last year followed shoppers, first around supermarkets and then around farmers markets. Now, you know the whole supermarket thing. I mean, you walk in, you fall into a light trance, you station, you circle the sort of stations of the cross at the supermarket, you come out with pretty much the same thing you had the week before. Maybe you discuss sort of debit or credit with the cashier. When they went to the farmer's market, they found people having 10 times more conversations. It wasn't just a kind of different method of procuring calories. It was an entirely different experience, and one that we can extend past food to energy, to entertainment. I mean, think about for a minute about the work you do. I mean, if someone submitted the business plan for KQED to business school, they would laugh at it. It flies in the face of human nature. Here's our business plan. We're going to give away our product, you know, free to everyone. And then twice a year, we're going to come on and hector people to send us a check for, you know, something that they get for free anyway. It shouldn't work according to the kind of economic laws that we spend much of our time firmly believing in. And yet it works exceedingly well. You've been here for a very long time. And in fact, public radio is, like farmers markets, growing and flourishing quickly.
You're talking about small community radio stations, too. I mean, in
low power FM, yeah. All sorts of things.
And as far as energy, neighborhood windmills, subdivision size solar panels.
Or just sort of energy that starts to work the way the internet does. I mean, I have solar panels on my roof. On a sunny day, I'm a utility. I'm sending electrons down the line. At night, I'm sucking them up like everybody else. But I'm putting in and taking out. I mean, we have this whole economic model now where there's some huge, centralized, and cheap way of doing everything. Archer Daniels Midland gives us our grain. ExxonMobil gives us our energy. Clear Channel and Infinity give us our radio signals. It's all cheap, and it's all bad, you know, in many ways, environmentally, culturally, whatever. We need to retake control of some of those things.
Here's the dilemma, though, Bill. In fact, it just came up a recent conversation I was having about independent bookstores, you know, because you talk about Walmart versus, you know, and so forth. And when you look at the chains and you look at the way they can underprice, it becomes a dilemma, particularly for people who don't have the luxury of having the kind of pocketbook where they can stretch.
Well, one of the questions that is going to come up over and over again is whether or not, with a lot of things, we're willing to pay a little more for them. For me, and I think in many cases, I mean, there's clearly people who can't at the moment make that decision because they're so stretched that it's impossible. But for most Americans, that's not yet the case anyway. And so we're forced to sort of start thinking about what it's worth in order to have a functioning community and about whether or not we really want more anyway. I mean, for me, a good analogy is, I live in a college town in Middlebury, so I watch a lot of freshmen arrive, and they quickly find out that drinking, you know, two or three bottles of beer on a Saturday night makes them feel good. And then over the course of the year, they discover that drinking, you know, 23 bottles of beer on a Saturday night there's no sort of linear improvement. In fact, they were better off with a little bit less. There are a lot of cases like that where what we need is not more entertainment, what we need is something that actually works for us. And, you know, an interesting place to look to sort of see confirmation of that is Western Europe. People in Western Europe, though they're as productive as we are in their jobs, have about half to two-thirds the amount of disposable income. They don't have as much stuff because, A, they're taking much more time They work many fewer hours than we do. And B, they're paying more in taxes so that they have health care, they have good public transit, they have retirement, whatever. What's interesting is two things. One, their satisfaction and happiness indices haven't declined the way ours have. They're much more have much more sort of grounding in the community, and so they're feeling better about their lives. And two, and here's an interesting kicker, the average Western European uses half as much energy as the average American. I mean, half is a big number. If we're going to be dealing with global warming, that's a lot more important than what we're going to get out of hydrogen or ethanol or any other kind of techno fix that we're talking about. It comes from a different approach to the world.
Is this a different approach? I mean, it is somewhat visionary, but yet it's kind of less is more redux in terms of sustainability and just the notion that consumption can't keep going on and has to have a terminus?
What's new is this real deep forming understanding, data-based understanding, that not only is our consumption causing huge ecological problems, it's not working for us.
It's the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah. And we've confused pursuit of happiness with pursuit of stuff. And it's, you know, it was an easy, it's easy to see how that confusion got started because to a certain point it works. I mean, you probably read, I know that when my daughter was a little younger, I read her all the Little House on the Prairie books, right? I mean, these are the kind of American texts. And they're amazing stories of strong community and family and of real material privation. You know, Christmas comes, and if you're lucky, you get a penny or a rag doll or a stick of candy or something. In that kind of world, it's easy to see how, you know, more was very attractive and how it led to better outcome. My daughter, you know, she likes rag dolls and stuffed animals too. But the, you know, the biodiversity of Beanie Babies in her bedroom mimics that of the deepest Amazonian rainforest. I mean, she doesn't really need another one. What the economists would call the marginal utility of the next stuffed animal is extremely low. She's like all of us. In a country where the fastest growing industry almost is storage lockers, we've long since passed the kind of point of material saturation. But our mind is still sort of formed by that earlier idea that some more stuff will provide an increment of pleasure that
maybe
just isn't
the little
coming.
House on the prairie, it also has to do with acquisitiveness and materialism.
Well, the point is that when we lived in Little House on the Prairie, it made some sense. When we live in Big House on the Cul-de-Sac, it doesn't make sense
anymore.
With two
master bedrooms.
Yeah.
Talking again with Bill McKibben. You mentioned global warming before. There's a National Day of Climate Action that you're heralding and getting started to some extent a grassroots movement. And I want to talk with you about that because I know our listeners will be interested in finding out about it. But there's some new data about global warming. And in fact, you talk about the bland James Hansen, as you describe him, of NASA and all this Greenbelt and Antarctic ice sheets melting. And you mentioned Jim Lovelock, who was on forum and who was talking about the necessity of going nuclear and said, I'll have, you know, nuclear stuff in my own local community. I'll have them even in my own swimming pool in my backyard if necessary, because this is what we have to do. Where do you stand on this?
On nuclear?
Yeah.
Well,
because he says we're past the tipping point on global warming. We've got to look nuclear.
The good thing about talking about nuclear power is it allows us to understand the danger that we're in, because everybody has a kind of strong reaction against a nuclear power plant in their neighborhood, and for obvious reasons, they're dangerous. But they're risky. A new coal-fired power plant in your neighborhood isn't a risk. It's a guarantee of deep damage, both locally and even more importantly, to the climate of the planet. So that's good to realize. However, I think Lovelock is completely wrong about the usefulness of nuclear power as a way out of this. If you give me $2 billion to build a new nuclear power plant, which is about what it costs, I can show you half a dozen easy ways to get four or five times the amount of carbon bang for the buck with that money, including, you know, right down to sort of going to Costco, buying compact fluorescent light bulbs and mailing them out at random to people in the San Francisco phone book. Conservation is so far and away the first if that's where the low-hanging fruit is. And that's what we need to really be working on at the moment. And, you know, in this national campaign we're talking about 80% carbon reductions by 2050. The first 20, 30, 40% of that is going to come far more easily from and far more quickly from learning how to conserve without any real changes in anything than it is from any new sources of power. And the next increment of it, I think, is going to come more easily from the kind of gradual, though fairly quick, I hope, switch to the sort of local and regional economies that I'm describing here.
Talking again with Bill McKibben, and we'll bring you into this conversation shortly. How do you change thinking on this, though? How do you get people to think different than they've been thinking sometimes their whole lifetime, that more is better?
Well, I don't have a great answer to that. I mean, that's why I write books and, you know, try to sort of get the information out. I think we're almost at this point pushing against an open door, an unlocked door. I think people are very close to this realization from many different directions. You know, I've spent a lot of time in the last year or two working with groups of, say, evangelical Christians who are quite able to, I mean, religious communities in general are organizations or institutions that, you know, at
their
core.
You see Neil Wilson's book?
Yeah. But at their core, they have, you know, this idea that there's something other than accumulation as the goal of life. You know, it's really possible. The problem is that maybe the biggest problem almost is psychological. What is it that we measure? Well, we measure gross national product. And hence, because we measure it, that's what we work on. If we were measuring, I mean, there are plenty of other indices that we could and should be paying as much attention to. One of them is these developing measures of human satisfaction. In fact, the Economist magazine, that radical sheet, started running an annual quality of life index issue where the U.S. fares unbelievably badly. I mean, we come in near the bottom of the heap for developed countries, and we're behind many developing countries on this list. And we got to start measuring ecological durability, because even if the life we were leading was making us, you know, happy as pigs in mud, it's not going to be possible to keep it going very much longer. That's what the science is making painfully clear at the moment.
So we were talking last hour about the history of the cigarette industry, and when you look at the diminution of those who are smokers because of shame, because of activism, because of changes in consciousness, it's pretty heartening. I mean, again, it certainly instills
a good
deal of hope.
Things happen quickly.
Well, and they do around here, too, as far as phone calls. I'm going to open up the lines and invite those of you who are listening to join us. Whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, you're welcome to be a part of this hour with Bill McKibben. His new book is Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. Our phone number, toll-free from wherever or however you're listening to Forum, 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or you can email us. Our email address here is forum, F-O-R-U-M, at kqed.org. And when we return your calls and emails, this is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with environmental writer and journalist Bill McKibben, who is known for his work on environmental issues, but also one of the first to make us apprised of global warming when it was maybe still just a dream in Al Gore's head. His new book is called Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future, and we're going to go to your calls here forthwith. Before we do that, though, speaking of global warming, there's a story here that needs to be told. That listeners need to hear.
You know, I've spent 20 years writing and talking about global warming. Finally, last summer, in a kind of moment of despair about how nothing was getting done, decided that I would try, you know, my hand at activism. And I'm not very good at it, I got to preface by saying. I live in Vermont, and I called a friend of mine and said, look, let's walk up to Burlington, our major city, and let's sit in at the federal building and get arrested and just see what happens. Maybe we'll get something going. I said, sure, but he actually called up to Burlington to ask what would happen if we did that, and the police department said, well, nothing. I mean, you can sit there as long as you want. So instead, we organized this this kind of march, this pilgrimage. Over the next 3 weeks, we organized it, and for 5 days, we walked about 50 miles, and by the time we got to Burlington, we had 1,000 people. Now, that's a lot in Vermont, and it was enough to change the politics of this issue in our state so that even our most conservative Republican candidates for federal office were endorsing this 80% by 2050 target.
Yeah, but you have a socialist senator.
Well, we do, but his very conservative opponent was right the same place he was on this issue. But what was depressing was to pick up the paper the next day and read that this 1,000 people we'd assembled was the largest demonstration about global warming that there'd yet been in the U.S., which just seemed staggering to us. So in January, with 6 Middlebury College students, I launched this website called stepitup07.org. And we urged people to organize rallies on April 14th in their local communities to demand this same 80% by 2050 cut. Instead of doing a march on Washington, we figured we could, you know, we didn't have the resources to do that. We didn't have any resources, but we figured we could, people could do this, and we could figure out how to link them together kind of on the web. We thought maybe we'd organize, if we were really lucky, 100 or 150 of these rallies by April 14th. As of this morning, after 10 weeks of organizing, I just checked the website. We're past 960 of these rallies in every state in the union. It's clearly going to be the biggest day of grassroots environmental protest since Earth Day 1970. We've got people who are holding underwater demonstrations, scuba divers off the endangered coral reefs in Key West. We've got thousands of people in blue shirts who are going to flood into lower Manhattan to show where the sea level will come. There'll be a sort of sea of people to demonstrate where the ocean will be if it rises 10 feet. Got people skiing in formation down the dwindling glaciers in the Rockies. We've got people out here doing parades of hybrid cars. In fact, there's going to be a bunch of actions that day in the Bay Area that you can find out about at stepitup07.org. But it just... it wasn't because of anything we were doing. As I say, I'm a terrible organizer, but people's desire to take action is finally, it's as if Hurricane Katrina and Al Gore's movie and that sort of level of education finally reached some tipping point, and now we've just sort of enabled people to start taking action too. It's very exciting to see. We may have maybe in that lies the kind of short-term emergency solution to some of the problems that we're in, that deep economy offers the kind of longer-term, more thoughtful way out of some of these problems, too.
There's a good deal of pride here in California in terms of what's being done about global warming.
Absolutely.
Justifiably. And yet at the same time, you know, you hear people like, well, James Hansen saying maybe 35 years, Lovelock saying it's over. The doomsayers are out there, and I guess you're countering them, or you feel you have to counter them.
Well,
you have the faith against them, don't you?
I think that, I'm not an unbelievable optimist. I mean, I wrote a book called The End of Nature. But I think that the best science demonstrates that we have a fast closing window in which to act. I mean, Jim Hansen, the NASA climatologist, said last year that we had 10 years worldwide in order to start reversing the flow of carbon into the atmosphere. Now it's 9 years. That's an extremely tall order. 9 years is 2 presidential election cycles. It's 4 congressional election cycles. And that's only in this country. I mean, even if we get our act together, which we show as of yet no sign of doing, we still have to figure out how to lead the rest of the world, especially China and India, in some positive direction. However, things are changing fast. Friday afternoon, I was stunned to flip on the computer and see that John Edwards had endorsed this 80% by 2050 drive. I mean, even 10 weeks ago, people were telling us this was way too radical, and we said we know we're at the outer edge of the politically possible here. But even in that 10 weeks, it's become much more thinkable, and it's got to become absolute standard issue, this is the minimum we can do over the course of the next little while, or it's not going to happen.
You're talking about presidential cycles. I'm looking at an email here from someone, who, the subject of which is Cassandra. Bill is totally right, but he's too late. Bush's damage to America and the world will take at least 50 years to remedy.
The biggest mistake, I think, that history will charge Bush with, I mean, in my mind, there's a long list, but maybe the biggest has been not our own failure on global warming, but our failure to do anything whatsoever to help nudge and ease China and India onto a slightly different energy trajectory just as their energy kind of takeoff was beginning. 6 years ago, with tons of money and diplomacy and hard work, we might have nudged them a little bit so that now their trajectory would be different. Instead of opening a new coal-fired power plant in China every week, maybe they'd be opening one a month and building a lot of windmills too. We missed that opportunity completely, and it's not coming back, and it makes the work we've got to do in the next 10 years, you know, unbelievably hard. The caller may be right. We may have one last bite at the apple, and I think if we do, it's well worth trying to take it.
Let's take your calls. Jeff, we begin with you. Good morning.
Good morning. Bill, I got to tell you, I haven't read your book yet, but I really love what you say. I mean, the point to me is that we have so many ways of measuring how much trouble we're in. And it is so disheartening to open the paper and to watch the TV and to find out another measure of how fast we're dying. Because the thing that we must have as a community and as a nation and as a planet is, how do we hold each other accountable, and how do we encourage the kind of behaviors and the kind of priorities that we need to carry? And my question was going to be, and you've already answered it, where do I go find my community of people that reflects this thing? And StepItUp07.org is perfect.
StepItUp07.org is a good place to start, and your local farmers market's a great place to start, and there are these stirrings everywhere, and the Bay Area, you know, has more of them than most places. And our task now is to figure out just how to give them this critical mass as fast as we can.
Well, thank you, Jeff, for your call. I want to get more of your calls on here, and we go to Dan. Dan, you're on. Dan, are you there?
I'm David, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, David.
That's okay. I just got back from living in Spain for a year, and I'm originally from L.A., and I have to say what you said really rings true. L.A. is such a private place where everyone drives everywhere. No one's happy. And I lived in a town called Cádiz in Spain, where there was plazas and a slower-paced life, and they had less stuff, but they were so much happier. It was amazing to see, and I'm going to try and influence that kind of way of life here now that I'm back.
Go to it, David, and thank you for bringing up the contrast to Spain. In fact, David mentions just L.A. and automobile communities, and here's Joe, one of our listeners, who says, the design model for our community since the 50s has been structured for the use of the automobile, using collector roads to get people from home to the strip mall and back. What can we do about this new urbanism?
This is a very good point, and it's one of the reasons that things are so difficult to change. We've built the worst possible system in a lot of ways. You know, we're very locked into it. One of the things that will happen if we're able in the short term to get real legislation about global warming is that inevitably the price of fossil fuels will begin to rise. I mean, that's one of the things that has to happen, and that price signal has to get sent. The force of economic gravity will stop working against public transit and against clustered housing, and it'll start working in their favor. It'll start working in favor of local food. I mean, we'll begin to see some of these transitions happening faster. This is a rate problem, you know. Given 100 years, we would solve this problem. We would figure out more interesting and durable ways to live than we do at the moment, because we're more interesting creatures, humans, than the kind of consumption machines that at the moment orthodox economics imagines us to be. Our only problem is that we don't have 100 years, and we got to figure out how to make this happen faster than it otherwise would, and it's going to be difficult. I mean, if we'd started 20 years ago on climate change, we could have taken more gradual steps. We could have eased our way in. We didn't do anything. We've had a 20-year bipartisan effort in Washington to accomplish nothing, and it's been highly successful. And so we're going to have to take much tougher action than we otherwise would have.
Here's one of our listeners, Tom, who says, this is supposed to be an ultra-logic era, but we've maintained a belief in a magical loaves and fishes economy. Interesting phrasing.
That's a good line.
Yeah, I like that too. The forever expanding economy, producing ever more wealth for more and more people, violates the most basic knowledge that civilization has been in possession of for centuries. How has this dream state persisted? And that's kind of the underlying question here as we deconstruct what you're talking about, isn't it?
Well, of course, we have one of the biggest industries in our country, advertising, takes as its job keeping that idea afloat. And I think at this point, there's a very real way in which
it's not only advertising, though, Bill. I mean, it's the whole nature of this economy built toward.
I completely agree.
We've got to have more profit in our margins. We've got to have our investors and our stockholders get more profit,
there's that,
et cetera, et cetera.
And there's also the individual level. I wrote many years ago this weird book called The Age of Missing Information. I went and found the largest cable TV system in the world, which was in Fairfax, Virginia. It had 100 channels. I taped everything that came across them for 24 hours. So I had 2,400 hours worth of tape. And I took it home and settled in for a year in the woods where I live and watched it. And, you know, there were a lot of things that came up. But the basic message that flows through that cable all the time is, you're the most important thing on Earth. You're the heaviest object in the universe. We've enshrined that idea now as human nature. But clearly, this isn't how most humans have figured out their identity at most times and most places. They've had other things, the tribe, the community, the natural world, the relationship with the divine, something else that sort of set their sense of who they were and allowed them not to be so central. Getting away from that, on the one hand, is going to be hard, but on the other hand, is going to be easy. Because the minute that we slip back into community, we discover that we like it. And from there, there's real possibility.
You've read Etzioni, haven't you?
Yes.
I mean, you know, he makes a real case for community elevating spirit and community really bringing people closer together to a kind of idealism that most of us in this republic, at least, feel that we share.
And the only quibble I have with the sort of communitarians is that they tend to think that the way to achieve this is to sort of preach about it and talk about it.
As opposed to living it?
Well, as opposed to building the set of daily institutions, farmers markets, you know, public radios, all those sort of things that require us to bump up against each other to actually, I mean, it's what you do every day that determines, you know, how you live, who you are, what your impact on the world is, not what you kind of think about these things. And at the moment, you know, we don't have the density of those kind of institutions, local economies that allow us to live that way, and that's what we need to build.
More of your calls. Gertie, thanks for waiting. You're on with us. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question regarding economic incentives for purchasing hybrid automobiles. We purchased one thinking that we were going to get approximately $3,000 tax credit, and it turns out you need to earn hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in order to be eligible for it. And if I believe, I think it was close to $700,000 a year, or be a family of four earning approximately $40,000 and under. And so all of us who are buying these hybrid cars are pretty much in the middle. And I'd like to know what your guest's opinion is about that, and was this just a giant scam that Congress put through, and what are they going to do to try to make people like us who want to help the environment but also perhaps have an economic incentive to bite at this rather than feel like we've been duped by the government. I'll take my answer off air. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Bill McKibben.
It's a good question. I don't know the specifics of the hybrid tax thing. I bought mine before there was such a thing. It makes much more sense if the government's going to be in the business of subsidizing things, it makes much more sense to subsidize new technologies that we need, like hybrid automobiles, rather than what we spend most of our subsidy dollars on, which are things that have political power, oil and coal, and that's where the subsidy dollars go. Big agribusiness, that's where the subsidy dollars go, instead of local farms, things like that. I would add, though, that to some degree, those of us who can afford in any way to do it need to be now, even before the government acts, taking some of these steps ourselves. I know a guy who I really admire in Colorado, Randy Udall, who's been doing solar.
Of the Udall family.
Yeah. He's been doing solar stuff for a very long time. He says, sometimes I get tired when people say, what's the payback time on my solar panel? No one says, what's the payback time on my new, 59-inch flat screen television? What's the payback time? To some degree, if we can afford to, we got to start making responsible decisions just because we understand they're responsible. That said, there should be all kinds of support for people doing things like buying hybrid cars. More to the point, there should be a law telling Detroit that they can't make anything but hybrid cars in 3 years' time. It's not like it's a very difficult technology, and if we did it, we'd, overnight be well on the way of the first decade's worth of that 80% cuts in carbon that we need to make.
Well, you mentioned Colorado and Randy Udall. It makes me think of the Rocky Mountain Institute and Amory Lovins. I mean, there's certainly been progress on that front.
Absolutely. Here's the thing with, climate change. We have many of the answers. We have the scientists. We have the engineers. Increasingly, we have the economists and the policy people who tell us what we need to do. The only thing we haven't had in the climate change movement is the movement part. Any real groundswell of people demanding action from their leaders. If we can get that, then we're going to see change happening quickly. I don't know if it's going to happen quickly enough. That's a hard call, but at least we'll have a shot.
Talking to Bill McKibben, and we'll go to more of your calls. We'll go next to Laura. Morning.
Hi, Bill.
Hello.
I really enjoyed listening to your discussion. My husband is in environmental economics, so we talk about this stuff a lot, about how to get different views of economics into the besides just crunching numbers. But my question is, you held up Western Europeans as kind of a model of less consumption and more happiness, and I've lived in Italy for a while and can agree with that, but I'm concerned about their declining numbers of population and how that indicates hopefulness, or what your take on that would be.
It's a good question, and one that I don't really know the answer to, but I think what it indicates is people who have bumped up against, just sort of physically, some of the limits of the world more quickly than we have in this country, and begun to respond to them. What's interesting to see is those European countries that actually have sort of stable birth rate and not a falling population are also the ones that have done the most things right in other ways. The Scandinavian countries in particular, which have pretty close to replacement population rates, but have incredibly low levels of impact on the environment, and unsurprisingly, have the highest results on these indices of satisfaction with their lives. But it's a very good point.
Yeah, think about all those depressed Swedes.
They actually turn out to be quite happy.
Have you seen too many Bergman movies? Well, maybe it's a different era. I don't know.
Or they're just happy in a different way, Michael.
Actually, speaking about population, Mark writes, what about limiting population growth by ending child subsidies, such as tax deductions for dependents, and also by more strictly limiting immigration, both legal and illegal?
Population is actually one of the places where, around the world, we're making some progress. If you had to pick one environmental statistic that was going the right way, that would be it. 30 years ago, the average woman in this world had 6 children. That number is well under 3 now and falling pretty fast. And the reason is that we've, around the world, begun to educate and at least modestly empower women to have some control over their lives, and hence they've chosen consistently to have fewer children. The demographers tell us that world population isn't going to double again. We'll go from 6 billion now to someplace in the neighborhood of 9 or 9.5 before population peaks. That's a lot. We're already struggling with 6, and that won't make it any easier. But at least there's kind of light at the end of that tunnel.
At least there are some results, and particularly in light of the fact that this administration has been so adverse to spreading information on contraception.
But what's interesting is, you would have thought that fertility was kind of hardwired into us in a Darwinian way, right, that there'd be some kind of biological imperative. It looks like fertility's incredibly plastic and, you know, affected by culture. It's consumption that we haven't yet sort of seen these same kinds of results with. And that's what is, you know, by now, the even more powerful problem that we need to deal with.
We'll bring more of our callers on. Hugh, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Thank you. As a subtopic, it appears that there's an underlying theme of both the hypocrisy of our government as well as ourselves as consumers that I want to pick up on. First of all, regarding government, in California, of course, they're promoting the control of greenhouse gases on local manufacturers and plants and stuff like that, which is excellent. But at the same time, they're saying they're going to leave the ports and imports alone, where even more greenhouse gases are caused. And India and China are already starting to argue that they won't follow until they are allowed to pollute as much as the Western countries have been allowed to do since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. And then secondly, as far as consumers, consumers often say, as you were referring to, that they want to see government do more, but then they don't go and support environmentally products in the stores. And of course, I'm not only talking about greenhouse gases, but any kind of pollution. So, for example, I buy and sell fabrics from all over the world, and consistently, consumers in stores only want price. That's all they care about. And as a result, U.S. companies that clean all the water coming out of their factories, or the inventor of fleece in the U.S. that makes 100% recycled products, is going out of business.
These are both good points. The first one is especially important. You know, California has done a really noble thing in passing this global warming legislation. And it's been very important in providing a spur to the rest of us to get our act together.
Now we have the whole Western states together, in fact.
But nobody, California included, is large enough to do this on their own. The pricing signal that we need to send about energy really can only come from Washington, and really only come from Washington acting in concert with the rest of the world. The first order of business is to get Washington to take seriously the need to change, partly because it'll help change things here, and partly because it'll get us back in the game internationally, allow us to be a part of those discussions. At the moment, the Chinese, I mean, we just serve as the enablers for the Chinese. We're each other's enablers in a sick codependent relationship about coal. And our desire to keep burning it and not do anything about it, we're each other's excuse for inaction, and that's got to stop.
We'll get more of your calls on. Ray, thanks for waiting. You're on. Good morning.
Hey, solstitial greetings. You know, Bill, I would hope that somebody would point out or enter into this discussion the seeming incongruity of planning for the next 50 to 100 years of uncertain supplies of water at the same time that some of the members of this discussion, such as people you mentioned, Mr. Lovelock, I think is one of them, such as promoting the construction of nuclear reactors, which by their nature have to sit in one place for 50 to 100 years in a secure water plane. If there isn't any reliable water, then you can't really put a nuclear reactor or a coal-fired plant in the mix, can you?
Water is going to be one of the truly powerful topics.
Can I give a plug here? Thursday is World Water Day. We're going to do an hour on water Thursday.
Oh, good. Well, it's important that you do because that's one of the things that's going to be and already is being most affected by change in climate. I mean, warm air holds more water vapor than cold air does. So we get dramatic increases in evaporation. In arid places. We're getting dramatic increases in precipitation in wet places. I mean, all that water comes down someplace. So we get deluge. We get increased tropical storminess. We get all kinds of flooding. Now we're seeing changes in sea level. We're obviously seeing changes in snowpack in the Sierras that are going to cause unbelievable havoc in this part of the world. I think that the single most important environmental this kind of arch stone for all these problems, the one that we've got to take on most head on is climate change. Because if we don't, it becomes incredibly hard to solve any of the rest of them. And one of the things about local economies that's important, I think, is that not only do they allow us in certain ways to head off some of these things because they use a lot less fuel, they also allow us to build the kind of resilient communities that may be able to withstand some of the forces that we're not able to head off. I mean, global warming is not going to get stopped. The question is miserable or catastrophic at this point. And in any event, we're going to be much better off in communities where we can depend on those around us, where we've built shorter lines of supply, where we have something other than consumption to entertain ourselves with.
Well, Bill, appreciate your being here. Good to see you. Thank you again for the work you do, and thank you for being with us this hour. And might as well give out your website once more since this thing is growing and growing.
StepItUp07.org. Michael, thank you so much.
Appreciate it. Deep Economy is the book, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. Bill McKibben, also author of The End of Nature. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. We'll be back with you if all goes according to plan on the morrow. We're going to talk about this whole controversy over human papillomavirus inoculations in our opening hour tomorrow, and then we're going to talk about Africa. There's a big trade and developing the continent meeting that's going on in San Francisco. We'll have some experts here on that tomorrow. I hope you'll join us. Our producers are Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And we thank you for your listenership. We would not be here without it. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.